I receive a lot of emails from students, particularly those interested in genetic counseling, and it's always a great way to connect and when I can provide resources. So I thought I'd let you know of Keck Graduate Institute's genetics programs in Southern California. KGI offers a master's degree in genetic counseling, and it provides students with a strong foundation in principal genetic counseling skills while gaining valuable experience in both the field and in the lab. They also offer a first-of-its-kind degree in genomic data analytics. Within that program, students gain hands-on experience with next-gen sequencing technology. Learn more about programs by visiting kgi.edu/DNA today. Again, that's kgi.edu/DNA today. Curious and want to try a DNA test, but concerned about your genetic data being shared? Secret Sequence is an anonymous genetic testing company. You never give your name for any reason, so they don't sell or share your data, unlike many other companies. They offer various tests, including ancestry, nutrition, exercise. I've done a few myself, and it's really interesting to learn about yourself. For $25 off two kits or more, head over to secretsequence.com and use promo code DNA today. Again, that's DNA today at secretsequence.com for $25 off two kits or more.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Tanin. On this show, I explore genetics and how it impacts our health, typically through interviews with genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, patient advocates, and more. My guest on this episode is a genetic counselor, Shanila Lakhani. She is the Director of Genetic Counseling and Clinical Engagement for the Center of Neurogenetics at Weill Cornell Medicine College, which is in New York City. In this role, she studies the genetics of neurodevelopmental disorders and neurological diseases of aging and adulthood. After recording this interview, she actually became my supervisor in my neurogenetics rotation as part of my genetic counseling graduate training through Sarah Lawrence. So it goes to show how small our field really is. Prior to Shanila's role at Weill Cornell, she was the first certified genetic counselor in Qatar, which is a country in the Middle East. And Shanila established the profession in this country and promoted genetics within the Middle East by speaking at international conferences. And in Qatar specifically, she helped to establish high-risk breast cancer screening guidelines and also a high-risk gastrointestinal clinic while contributing to local testing and screening guidelines. So on this episode, we discuss what it was really like to be the first certified genetic counselor in a country and how she was able to start the profession there and really make an impact in public health in Qatar. So thank you so much, Shanila, for coming on the show and sharing your experience with us as a trailblazing genetic counselor.
Thank you so much for having me here today, Kira.
Yeah, I'm really excited to learn more about it. I met you in person and everything, and I was just like, well, we need to capture your story and your energy on the show. So before we get into all of that, I wanted to ask you what your elevator pitch is when people ask you, like, what does a genetic counselor do? Because I think everybody's answer is a little bit different, and it's interesting to hear how people phrase that.
It's such an interesting question. It's, you know, I've been doing this for over 10 years now, and I think the answer to that question has changed as sort of this profession has changed over time. And I think so much has happened since I graduated that I think what I used to say has completely changed. So, you know, it's great to see that people actually have more experiences with genetic counselors, so it's not as hard to give that answer because nowadays at least somebody knows of somebody or might have experienced a session with a genetic counselor. So it's gotten a little bit easier, but typically I stick to a pretty standard sort of elevator pitch, which is genetic counselors are clinicians and we specialize in helping individuals understand their genetics as it relates to human health. And then always focusing also that we've also been trained to address the unique psychosocial issues that often go along with genetic disorders. You know, I always try to introduce the concept that we're not only in clinic settings, but research, labs, academia, we own private businesses now, policy making, really. I feel like there's nothing we can't do at this point.
We're becoming in all areas of healthcare. And I think, yeah, the last part of what you said of just like those different areas, that's probably the newer part of your answer. Whereas 10 years ago, maybe you were a little bit more like, yes, we're focused on healthcare. You can find us in hospitals. And so it's changing so much. It's only been 10 years for you and it's already changing.
That's exactly it.
So I want to talk more about how you became the first certified genetic counselor in Qatar. When I heard this, I was like, wow, that's amazing that you went into a country and just started genetic counseling there. What was the path to get there? Like, what inspired you to actually have a position there? And how did that come into your path?
You know, it's funny hearing that now, because it almost sounds like I had this great vision and I'd had everything planned out, but it was all really very serendipitous. I was a second year master's student at McGill, and it just so happened that the head of clinical genetics out in Doha, so the capital of Qatar, he trained at SickKids in Toronto, and he was experienced working with genetic counselors. He knew what we were able to do, the services we could provide, and how much better a clinical service can be with a genetic counselor. And so he was quite keen to incorporate that into the healthcare system in Qatar. So he reached out to some of the Canadian program directors he was more comfortable or he knew well. And at the time, Jen Fitzpatrick, who is the current program director at McGill, she approached me about considering the job. We're about to be graduating. Every one of us were looking for jobs. And she is a great mentor and encouraged me to go out there and consider the position. So it was just for an interview. And I think she thought that what they called me was a free spirit. And my personal experience in the Middle East, when I would visit my grandparents, it could be a job I would really enjoy and thrive in. So that's sort of what led me there. It wasn't something I sought out. I remember when somebody asked me if I would be interested in thinking about going to Qatar, I had to Google it and look it up because I'd never heard of it.
I did too.
So it was, it all just happened a little bit, really out of nowhere.
And so once you heard about this, you were like, okay, am I going to move here? You probably didn't know too much about the country. That must have been kind of a challenging decision to make. I mean, it sounds like an amazing opportunity and, you know, the ability to make such a major impact on a country. But at the same time, I'm sure you were kind of nervous about some of the challenges. Like, was there anything in particular that you were like, I don't know about this aspect of it?
So much. I think I was extremely nervous. I could tell you that I think I cried most of the 12-hour flight there. It was a lot of aspects of it was challenging. I'd never really left home, like Canada or North America. I was going to be very far away. And I think the part that I was most concerned about was that not being able to do what was required of me as a new graduate. And I think that was the part that I was most nervous about because, you know, I had just graduated. I was well aware of my limitations, perhaps, as an experienced genetic counselor. And so I think the best piece of advice I got was, again, from my program director. And she told me that being able to ask for help when you need it and building a network of genetic counselors that you can rely on could really help you in any job you take. And so that, to me, was extremely insightful, is that, you know, you're not really alone because you have this network. We have, you know, the National Society of Genetic Counselors, and that's just a ginormous network, but also the graduates that you graduate with. So you know when to ask for help. And I think that helped me sort of accept this position because I knew that I could always turn to someone for help.
So even though you're in a new country and you're really starting genetic counseling services there, you knew that you could reach back out to the classmates you graduated with, the larger alumni network, and other genetic counselors that maybe you didn't even know to be able to connect with through National Society of Genetic Counselors and everything. So kind of, it sounds like a mix, like you were there and spearheading everything, but at the same time, you had other resources to kind of connect with and touch base with.
And that's it. That's it exactly. And I think that's true in all of the jobs. And I think many of us can probably feel that way, is that I've spoken to so many people that have helped me in so many different cases here and in Qatar where you might not have ever met them. And genetic counselors are just so good at reaching out to other genetic counselors, and they're always happy to help. Right? Because ultimately, you want the best for your patients or for the healthcare system or for the population at large. And so it's definitely a team effort.
So I want to learn a little more about Qatar itself and the population and what was involved with your role there and things that you were able to set up so that once you left, there was different kind of programs in place and screening and all of that. But to start out, what are some of the most common genetic disorders that you see in guitar? And is that a little bit different from North America, or is it very similar?
So I think if I had to think about the most common ones, so we saw a lot more rare conditions just because of the nature of the complexity of the demographics there. But the most common conditions I would see would be the inborn errors of metabolism, which are, you know, a group of metabolic disorders. Most significantly, Qatar has the highest rate incidence of homocystinuria. And so I don't see that as much here, but that's also probably because now I'm more specialized in neurogenetics. And so a lot of the conditions that we would see in Doha were those that were autosomal recessive. So they're inherited through usually unaffected carrier parents. And so that's what we saw much more of. And it's probably due to the nature of the population. So sort of they're homogenous, they were relatively isolated for a long period of time, and there is a high rate of consanguinity in that population that we might not see as much of here in North America.
And for those that may not know, because it's one of those genetic counseling terms, what does consanguinity mean?
So consanguinity, if you're taking the technical term, is used to describe when two people are related through a common ancestor. So it's no more remote than a great-great-grandparent. So for an example, the most common consanguineous union observed in the Middle East is typically first cousin marriages.
And this is more common in Qatar than, say, North America.
Right. So we'd say over 50% of marriages in Qatar, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, where there's a higher proportion of Muslims, are considered consanguineous.
And how did this change your genetic counseling approach? Because in North America, we don't come across that as much as you did in Qatar. Does that change the way you're having the conversation, or is it really similar?
I think you have to be a lot, you have to feel a lot less judgmental if that's how they might feel. You never want to phrase that question in a way where people might feel like they've done something that's causing this to happen to their either their children or in their family. So you never want to give someone the feeling that it's because they married somebody within the same family that this is at fault. So I think that you become much more sensitive in the languages you might use or the way you ask that question. So it is my second nature because, you know, counseling in Qatar, there was more chances than not that the couple or the family in front of me is likely consanguineous, and that's a very normal social norm. And I think that perhaps for me, it wasn't too much of a shift because I'm South Asian. And so this was something that I was aware of culturally my whole life.
During this quick break, I wanted to remind you about Keck Graduate Institute's master's program in genetics. KGI is an innovative grad school that is a member of the Claremont Colleges in Southern California. Their name might sound familiar if you listen to the genetic counseling application episodes with Brenna, one of my friends that's a genetic counseling grad student there. In addition to genetic counseling, KGI offers a master's degree in genomic data analytics. Graduates of that program will gain the ability to translate research into precision medicine. Learn more about KGI's two genetic programs by visiting kgi.edu/DNA today. Again, that's kgi.edu/DNA today. And an aspect of this that you kind of touched upon is carrier testing, and where a couple will come in and see if they are a carrier for the same genetic disorder that puts their offspring at risk, so their future children at risk. And this was initiated that, you know, you had a, sounds like a really big role in having people go through carrier testing, where maybe beforehand it wasn't as streamlined or wasn't as common. What was your role like in this process, and what information did you make sure you had to cover and other psychosocial considerations that you had so that you were being very respectful of their culture, but also making sure that you're educating them properly? Like, where was that balance?
So I think kind of comes in, it was an initiative of population health screening. And so this is actually something that they had realized a very long time ago in Qatar, that you might not be able to stop cultural norms or choices individuals are making. So then how can we screen for individuals prior to that? So really thinking of how you can prevent genetic diseases. And one of those strategies was the newborn screening and something called premarital screening. So often individuals may not know they're carriers of diseases. And this is true for, you know, pan-ethnically everywhere in the world. And you don't usually realize until there is a child that's born with a genetic condition. So often we're working backwards in genetics. And that has changed significantly with the advances of, for example, carrier screening, which is common throughout the world now. So in Qatar in particular, it was sort of a very valuable set of skills to be able to provide carrier testing to individuals in a family. So let's say, for example, there was a couple and they had premarital screening. So that means that any couple who wants to go ahead and obtain a marriage license would be screened for specific conditions that are more common in Qatar. So, for example, I'd mentioned homocystinuria. There is founder mutations for cystic fibrosis. They screen for thalassemia. And so if both of the partners were carriers, before they could apply for the marriage license, they would need to receive genetic counseling. So really the whole idea was just so that they were aware that they were both carriers, what the risk was. So typically if it's recessive, obviously it's 25%, and the options that may be available. So the whole idea of this is not to stop individuals, but was to make sure that they were informed of what the choices were, whether that be prenatal testing or perhaps pre-implantation genetic diagnosis or PGD. For me, that was a great opportunity. And this is what, you know, I spoke to a lot of the physicians and when I did a lot of lecturing and teaching there, was that at that moment, given the cultural norms, typically these partners are going to come in with family members. And it's really important for me, and I feel like that is a teaching moment for them to understand that now that we know that these two individuals are carriers, and they found this out, you know, perhaps a bit down the line when the marriage has already been sort of decided and they were going to go ahead with this. But now I know that there is a very good chance that many people in this family may be carriers and that they all have the ability to pursue carrier screening. So my hope was that they can learn this earlier on so that if there is ever any partners being chosen in the family, or if there's any discussions of marriages, they had that information before it was too late.
And if there were people in the family that were affected by a condition, that might be your introduction to talk to them about the genetics behind that condition and possible treatments that maybe they weren't aware of.
Exactly. So I think that would be a prime example for the newborn screening. So they test for over 30 disorders, and at that opportunity, most of them are recessive, and they again would see a genetic counselor or a geneticist. And that's another opportunity where if we know this child has a metabolic condition that's recessive, we almost immediately can assume there's obligate carrier parents. We can confirm those findings and provide the same type of counseling to other family members. And I think one thing that's important is that often if they are either from the same tribe, the same area, or if they're consanguineous, this might be the norm in that family. So it might be something that's happened multiple times. So it's not unusual to see multiple loops of consanguinity. And so it's extremely important that carriers are aware, because they're often telling me, oh, my sister's actually married to his brother as well. So that immediately is telling you that there is other individuals that could really benefit from carrier genetic counseling. And I always felt like I did a good job when, you know, somebody shows up at my office and they'll knock and they might not know exactly the name, they might not know the gene, they won't know it's recessive, but it'll be, my sister's son told me that I should come here to hear about testing. And so that's when, that's your opportunity to sit down and explain exactly what that entails.
And that's when you get to be in the detective role of taking their family history and seeing what is evident in the family and explaining to them and how that could impact them, how that could impact their children, and really going with that educational piece. Something else that you mentioned was having that it's common to have not just the couple in your office for carrier testing or going over results, but the whole family. Which I think is a little bit different from North America. Usually when I've seen sessions and, you know, it's a couple people in the office, but it's not more than that.
I think that's definitely one of the probably biggest differences I've seen from counseling in North America and overseas. It's much more of a family affair. And I think that, again, you have to think about the cultural backdrop of where you're counseling. You have to think about the norms of society and what's appropriate and what's not in your role as a healthcare provider. So it would be very unusual, specifically for premarital, if they did not come in with extended families, at least, just because of religious considerations as well as cultural. So it often was a full room. You know, if it was pulling up chairs, even sometimes for disclosure for hereditary conditions, it was much more of a family affair.
And I can imagine those sessions running a little bit longer than your typical maybe 45 minutes to an hour and a half.
That's right. So it would definitely take much longer. I was quite fortunate. We had a lot of flexibility in scheduling. And the other aspect of that was often I had a translator. And so that added another layer of sort of extending the session and becoming much more well-versed in asking questions so that I was sure that they were comprehending what I was saying. So I think I used a lot of different genetic counseling techniques, like having them paraphrase, what did you understand of what I've said, or asking them a question to see whether or not their response made sense in the context of what I had explained to them. So there was definitely a different skill set that I had to use to ensure that I was actually relaying information correctly.
And using a translator is a whole nother really layer to a session, and there can be more miscommunications and being able to really rely on your translator. Was this a translator that you had in person or using like a phone translator?
No, so she was a nurse and we worked together exclusively. So I think after 3.5 years, I could understand enough Arabic to know if there was any lapse in understanding, and she knew a lot about genetics. She was a trained nurse. After working with me, we would even go through sort of our own educational seminars together so that she understood the basis of genetics so that I felt comfortable with her explanation. So I was actually very fortunate.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm sure genetic counselors that are listening are like, I wish I had my own personal translator in person.
I think that was the perk of what was given to me as coming in to help them set up their genetic counseling services.
Definitely. And so you're in Qatar and you're a trailblazing genetic counselor there, but also as a student intern during your summer rotation, right? You went to Morocco?
That's right.
Yeah, which you're just so worldly. It's amazing. I read your piece in the Journal of Genetic Counseling kind of talking about your experience and looking at that delicate balance of like respecting patients' cultures while introducing counseling styles that maybe they're not really used to, of having a healthcare provider not just giving them information but helping them process it. How did this shape you as a genetic counselor of you know, this is me in a couple months of being you know, a summer intern and everything, of coming with your own style but also looking at different patient populations?
I think it was a great eye-opener for me. So I lived my entire life in Canada. I went to school in Canada, and it was a firsthand experience that one size, or perhaps, you know, one model of genetic counseling doesn't fit all. And I think that's an extremely important lesson to learn as a genetic counselor, because I just thought that as a student, this is how it works. Everyone should be, it's non-directive. They should obtain all the information that we have because it's their right. And then coming to a country where healthcare is provided in a very different way, and that, you know, there's no genetic counselors there. They might not have the same accessibility to testing or to treatment, more importantly. And so you started learning a little bit more about, you know, are you doing more harm? And I think one of the biggest things is sometimes there isn't a right or wrong answer. There is what's less wrong or perhaps what's more right. And I think that seeing that firsthand in the patient population there and realizing that, you know, there are other models and one might not be better than the other, but you have to really look at what is your end game. And it's really to help the patient population, right? It's to help these families, and you're relaying information. And even now there's tiers of what is the most important thing I need them to walk away with. What is sort of additional information that's really helpful for some patients, but perhaps will be detrimental or will be more damaging because then they won't walk away with a full understanding because they've picked up bits and pieces. And so I think Morocco as a student for me was just such an eye-opener. I think that's where my interest in the cultural aspects of genetic counseling really stemmed from.
Yeah, I can imagine that just being a very immersive experience, and coming from Canada, where you have universal healthcare, is probably vastly different. Whereas in the U.S., there's kind of a mess of different insurance layers and everything. But that's, I can imagine, quite a stark difference.
Exactly. And I think that every time I've moved somewhere, there's been different aspects of it that shape the way some genetic counselors work. So I think I came from universal healthcare. We had a very different paradigm in healthcare. And then I went to Qatar, where it's a completely different healthcare system. And then coming to the US, and you realize sometimes what you're able to offer, it's not always what might be recommended or indicated. Sometimes it's what's the best that you can do given the healthcare system you're working in.
And I think that highlights a skill that genetic counselors have in their adaptability between patient populations of, in some places you're offering them the most, the highest tier testing, as you were kind of saying, and the most expansive, whereas in other cases you may be saying, well, here's your options, but which makes the most sense to you, and having to adapt your style of not only what you're offering, but also how you are phrasing things. And, you don't know if you're talking to someone that didn't finish high school or someone that has a PhD in genetics. So it's kind of constantly having to adapt to who you're with and what culture you're in and everything. And that's something that's probably never going to change in genetic counseling. We're always going to be adapting to our audience.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think you're right. We're really good at it. There's a lot of research coming out about the best way to handle the situation, because we're learning more and more and what kind of information is most valuable to different populations. And I think that's a key point, is that what might be valuable to you and I, or, the person you see in New York, might be very different than the type of information that somebody from a different country, a different culture, a different language might find valuable. So who are we to decide what information is most valuable? And I think we're learning just as a profession and as a healthcare sort of paradigm of what that entails.
Definitely. Well, with all of this experience, what kind of advice do you have for maybe prospective or practicing genetic counselors that are interested in this public health angle and maybe toying with the idea of starting a genetic counseling service, whether it's in a country that has no genetic counseling or if it's in a private practice session that, private practices are kind of starting to pop up in genetic counseling? What kind of wisdom do you have to bestow upon us? No pressure, right?
I think it would be the same advice that was given to me. And, I always tell students that rotate with me here at the Center for Neurogenetics at Cornell that you'll learn far more from your mistakes than your successes. And I think every hurdle is an opportunity to learn a new skill. And our training is often, it's structured. We have board exams, we have accreditation milestones that we need to, complete. We have diseases we need to study for, information that's necessary to become competent. But I think that sometimes we forget that the skills that we've gained in school and out in the workplace are extremely adaptable and versatile. So, you might ask genetic counselors, and then we might give you the same type of answers that, oh, we relay information or we translate it. But we have a skill set that, if utilized to our full potential, allows us to take on a multitude of career paths and roles, including leadership roles. And I think that not to limit yourself would be my wisdom, because we graduate and with a skill set that really can be applied in so many circumstances, and that it might be your fear that will limit what you're able to do.
But feel the fear and do it anyway.
Exactly. And just learn from any mistakes you make. I think the worst thing we can do is to not acknowledge mistakes that we make along the way and miss that opportunity to be better.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for, sharing a glimpse into what it was like to be the first certified genetic counselor in Qatar, and kind of getting there and being very honest, saying that it was a hard decision to go to, but it sounds like it really was able to jumpstart your career. And, coming right out of coming right out of a genetic counseling master's program and launching into that, it's very admirable.
Thank you. And, I've never regretted that decision for a minute. And that's not to say, I think whenever I came home, I was that person crying in the airport every single time I got back on a plane. But it was amazing, I think, as a new graduate, to be able to see firsthand and sort of to be thrown in where you have to either learn to swim or sink. It really made you realize your full capabilities. And so I would encourage anyone who's thinking about that to know that more than 10 years ago, we have an even stronger network now, and there is genetic counselors basically across the world. And so if you have that desire and that passion. I think there's so many outlets now that are available to you.
Well, thank you again so much. Really appreciated hearing your perspective on this and bringing your passion onto the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Kira.
Learn more about Shanila's current role at neurogenetics.weill.cornell.edu. And if you have questions for her or me about this episode, other episodes, you can email in at info@dnapodcast.com. And dnapodcast.com has all of these episodes, along with any links we may mention during an episode of articles or resources. So you can check that out, dnapodcast.com. On social media, Twitter, I'm at DNA Podcast, Instagram at DNA Radio. Recently did a contest for Rare Fair 2019, which is a virtual conference for the rare disease community. So lots of contests going on there and other interesting content. And I wanted to mention my next episode is a special installment. Two of my peers from my genetic counseling class, Ali Cantu and Catherine Mayo, are joining me to celebrate the 22nd anniversary of Gattaca. If you haven't seen this movie, definitely watch it before listening to our conversation. It's a dystopian sci-fi thriller with designer babies, and it really explores so many bioethical genetic issues. Might be my favorite movie. This episode drops on the actual anniversary, which is Thursday, October 24th, and we will be discussing the film's relevance today in the field. I wanted to remind you about Secret Sequences, exclusive offer to you as a DNA Today listener. If your genetic privacy is important to you, but you still want to do a DNA kit, head over to secretsequence.com and use code DNA Today at checkout for $25 off two kits or more. I've done a bunch of the kits myself, ancestry, exercise, nutrition, and skincare. If you want to hear about my experience using those, listen back to episode 105 with the founders. I share some of my results on there, parts of which were new information for me, like being at a higher risk for joint injuries and fractures, something to keep in mind with my workouts. Also, that a Mediterranean diet isn't likely to be as effective as a low-fat carb diet for me to maintain a healthy weight. Other results confirmed what I've already experienced in life, such as liking the bitter taste of coffee. I actually drink it pretty much black, only a little sugar, while being really sensitive to its caffeine and having sensitive skin and bad acne, not the best genes I've inherited. Check it out for yourself using promo code DNATODAY at secretsequence.com. Be sure to follow them on Facebook. They're at Secret Sequence Official. Thanks for listening and join me next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, they're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of